The NFL Draft broke another attendance record as its commissioner pitched a longer regular season. The Arena Football League just relaunched and it's already a mess, and we are diving into the incentives in baseball that are leading to numerous pitcher injuries with the Score's Travis Sawcheck. It's Monday, April 29th. I'm Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. The NFL Draft made another startling display of the NFL's popularity by breaking an attendance record. 775,000 people came to Detroit for the event, up from 312,000 last year in Kansas City. The draft is also a public moment for NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who made some news on the Pat McAfee show when he pitched a new schedule for the league.
I think I'd rather replace a preseason game with a regular season any day. That's just picking quality, right? So If we got to 18-2, that's not an unreasonable thing. The other thing it does, which I thought you were going to, is that ends up on President's Day weekend, which is a three-day weekend, which makes the Sunday night, and then you have Monday off.
Just to put that all together, that would be two preseason games instead of three, an 18-game regular season, and the Super Bowl on President's Day weekend. Here's the thing with that. If the NFL wants to go to 18 games, the NFLPA is going to need something in return, and there's a pretty obvious starting ask: a second bye week. That would push the Super Bowl to the week after President's Day, which seems like a fixable problem. You could just move the whole season up a week, but that might involve talks with the league's media partners, which makes things that much more complicated. The bigger issue is that the game takes an incredible physical toll on players' bodies, but the NFL is the most popular sport in America, and the league wants to max out on what it has. The Arena Football League launched its third iteration over the weekend, and one of its teams may already be imploding. The league existed from 1986 to 2008, relaunched in 2010, shut down again in 2019, and has just begun its third attempt. But one of its 16 teams, the Philadelphia Soul, didn't quite make it to the starting line. On Friday, reports came out shortly before the team's first game on Saturday that most players were given termination forms, effective immediately. Further reports indicated that the players, staff, and coaches had not been paid, and their hotel in New Jersey near their team facility was also not covered, which led the hotel to refuse to release the players' stuff until they received their payment. A source also said that the team had only been provided with one-way tickets to New Orleans, but it doesn't seem like many of them actually got on the plane. Apparently, the players wearing Philadelphia Soul jerseys in their 53-18 loss to Louisiana were mostly players hired from the Dallas Falcons of the American Arena League. Those players might not have been ready after being called in on short notice, but at least they probably knew the coach. The team hired Dallas Falcons coach Tyrone Washington after the previous head coach, Pat Pimmel, abruptly resigned earlier this week. Who owns this team, you might ask? The answer is the Arena Football League itself owns the Soul, or whatever is left of it, and that is not a good sign. Up next, one of the big stories of the 2024 baseball season so far is about who is not playing. The list of top-tier pitchers missing significant time grows practically every week. But is this an abnormal year, or is this just reality for baseball right now? My next guest, Travis Sawcheck, has looked into this. We talked about that, the state of labor relations in the sport, and more. And that's coming up next. All right, I am joined now by Travis Sawcheck, MLB senior writer at The Score. Welcome, Travis.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So a lot of the early season discourse in baseball has been on pitcher injuries. Spencer Strider, you know, the consensus best pitcher in baseball, is out for the year. Garrett Cole, you know, won the Cy Young last year, is going to miss about half the season. There are many, many others. You've looked into this. Are there, in fact, more injuries this year?
It sure seems that way, which is why I looked into it. And it's bad, but my takeaway is that it's always been this bad this time of year, mm-hmm. early in the season, at least over the last decade. And we looked at the Tommy John database for the first 100 days of the calendar year, dating back to the first Tommy John surgery. And really, the first 100 days are not elevated to the major league level, but if we include the minor league level, it's not an outlier first 100 days in recent years. And I think it's just, you know, the names you mentioned, the Striders, the Garrett Coles, the Shane Beavers, that makes it seem, not that Coles headed for Tommy John surgery, but it just, the names involved with elbow injuries make it seem worse than it is, but that's also not to say that it's good. And I think, you know, there are too many injuries. I think 37% of pitchers on rosters today in the majors have had Tommy John surgery,
wow,
which is, it's remarkable. I suppose it speaks to the quality of the procedure and the return to play programs in place, but it also speaks to that's a lot of injuries and that's a lot of stress on the human body. So yeah, I guess to summarize it is, it's certainly not good, but it's also in line with recent years, which is surprising.
Yeah, that 37% figure is pretty remarkable. Didn't realize, I mean, it makes enough sense. Didn't realize it was that high, though. There does seem to be a causal relationship probably between throwing harder and getting injured. Do you think there's something to that?
Yeah, I think there certainly is. It's tough to isolate any one variable, but when you do look at the highest velocity guys, their injury rates do seem to be higher than the overall general population of pitchers, and they are acting rationally. I mean, you look at offensive performance against higher velocities and it's lower. You look at who is drafted in the early rounds of the draft. You're not going to see many low velocity arms. Who enjoys above average major league pay? Generally, it starts with they're very good pitchers, and generally that starts with an above average fastball. So I think pitchers know the risks, but they also know the rewards. And there was Tyler Glasnow the other day on Chris Rose's podcast, who was, he mentioned the 1 year when he tried to not sell out for velocity. He had a 7.7 ERA in Pittsburgh. Wow. And he said, pitchers know the risk, but they're always going to make this decision with where the game is, because that's the incentives, the financial reward, the performance rewards are all in many ways tied to pitch quality, and velocity is a huge component of that. So it's no one wants to see these injuries, but it's also hard to see incentives changing. I don't see many pitchers trading velocity to lower injury risk. We only see velocities climbing. So I don't know how that changes. I don't know if it will change. Perhaps with all the modern training tools, pitch design tools, maybe there can be more Logan Webbs who become more movement-based, more sinker, change-up, slider-based, and can use the high-speed cameras and pitch tracking tools to become those types of arms. Maybe there's a window for that. But yeah, the incentives right now are definitely aligned with taking on that risk for chasing that reward.
I mean, you wrote a book called The MVP Machine about these modern ways that players, pitchers, and hitters are trying to get better. You know, driveline baseball, I think, is the most well-known of those, where they teach pitchers to throw harder, but also to, they work with hitters. They help pitchers come up with new pitches. Yeah, do you see a path in that direction of, maybe even if we're not solving the whole velocity conundrum, at least kind of creating new ways for pitchers to be effective without adding a couple miles an hour to their fastball?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I do think there are folks in baseball looking into this. And again, I think Logan Webb is kind of like the model for this, and not everyone moves like Webb, not everyone has the same characteristics. But here's a guy who had Tommy John surgery in 2016, I believe, who the Giants had been at one point. He was trying to ride the fastball up in the zone, seek out velocity. I think he was hitting 97 when he had the Tommy John surgery. And it was when Brian Bannister, who's now the White Sox pitching coach, when he came in at the end of 2019, and he told Webb, you're going to change everything. It was a phone call after Christmas, and Webb said it was like 45 seconds of small talk. And then he went right into, yeah, we're going to change everything you do because this isn't working. And he did become a guy. He lowered his arm slot. He became a, instead of a north-south arm, to just speak generally, more of an east-west, where late movement, arm side, glove side run, sinkers off changeups and sliders. And he's thrown the sixth most innings in baseball the last 3 years. He's become one of these rare volume guys we just don't see anymore. And, pitch design, a lot of the player development focus, as I wrote about in that book, and is really it's only accelerated since then. It's been on focusing on velocity, four seamers up in the zone, hard breaking stuff off of it. And a lot of these tools could be used to, you know, train the web style of pitching if you're interested to it. And we've had breakthroughs like the, not to dive into too nerdy of a rabbit hole, but like seam shifted wake, the way the seams on the ball interact, it helps a pitcher like Webb. You get more than expected movement if you can harness and design pitches where the seams interact with, you know, the airflow around it in a certain way. So we don't know exactly where the game's going to go. And I think the new technologies allow for new discoveries and understanding of pitching. So maybe that's a solution. But again, to the original kind of what we're seeing in the game, the injuries, while they're not elevated versus recent years, they're still elevated in regard to historical terms that we know of. And it is alarming. I mean, to lose a Strider so early, to lose, to be without a Gerrit Cole. And, you know, Shane Bieber did go to driveline this offseason. He did add velocity. He also sharpened breaking balls. And this is a conundrum, right? Like Bieber in his first two starts and in spring looked as good as he'd looked on the mound since he won the COVID shortened year. I believe he won the Cy Young. He looked as good as he had since that year. And then he gets hurt. And again, risk reward. He was entering a free agency year. He was trying to be the best version of himself. And, you know, did his offseason training play a role in injury? It's impossible to say, but it does make sense that the more stress you put on a human body, the more injury risks are going to be elevated.
One thing that's kind of come out of this is, so MLB, obviously you have the pitch clock now, they shortened it this year to make things just a little quicker. The MLBPA came out and said, you know, that's why we're seeing all these injuries is pitchers' arms aren't getting a chance to you know, rest and reload just between pitches. Those seconds are costing them. And you know, it may not be true. Obviously your research shows that there aren't more injuries from before the pitch clock. Anyway, I'm more interested kind of in the labor unrest part of this. It feels like, you know, we just had a very contentious CBA negotiation led to a 99-day lockout. The next one's just a couple years away. And it feels like there's already a lot of tension both within the MLBPA and between the MLBPA and MLB. I'm wondering kind of what you're forecasting in terms of what we might see for the next round of negotiations.
Yeah, we're still a few years out, and it already feels like it's setting up to be another ugly round of talks. And
it'd be surprising if it wasn't ugly at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you have the players and owners who are, you know, there's quite a bit of animosity. I suppose there always is in a CBA negotiation, but it seems even elevated historically. And there's some fractures between player groups. I mean, you have, there's just different interests. And it really goes back to the vote on the CBA. If we, the time of the last vote, there's the executive player board, which included eight players. They had eight votes, and they were made up mostly of veteran star players. I believe five of the eight were Scott Boras clients. And then you had the general population of player, which accounted for, I think it was another 30 votes or something. But the general group of players overwhelmingly supported getting back to accepting the deal and playing. And the executive board voted unanimously 0-8 against the deal. So you have these competing interests of players where if you look at performance value on the field, younger players who are in that pre-arbitration group account for the overwhelming majority of wins above replacement production, roster size. They make up 60% of plate appearances and innings pitched, yet they're generally compensated near the minimum salary in baseball. And that minimum salary it did enjoy a bump in the last deal, it still lags behind those of most of their other North American sport contemporaries. And then you have the interests of the one percenters that want to be unencumbered and as free a market as possible. And those interests kind of compete against the general pool. You have this de facto soft cap of sorts and the tax, luxury tax, which should strengthen over time, and nothing on the bottom end to force owners, ownership groups in places like Oakland and Miami and Pittsburgh and Cleveland to meet a minimum payroll floor. And it's just a whole, and revenue sharing, and it's just really a mess. And it, if players want to fight for earlier access to free agency, I mean, things like that, or even expanded Super 2, those are just huge fights that would require lengthy work stoppages. And who's willing to sacrifice that? And owners always have the advantage where they don't have these finite careers like players do, that, you know, the average player career is over in less than 3 years. So how much time are you willing to sit out to really fight for something? So yeah, it's not looking great is how I would state it, Owen.
Yeah. Let's wrap up with a sort of more fun topic. One of your campaigns in the baseball world is, you know, we're probably going to add two teams sometime in the next few years, or, you know, like 5-6 years. Then we'll have 32, and it's nice power of two. We can break it into two 16 team leagues. You're advocating, I believe, for get rid of interleague play and redo the divisions. So it's, you know, like the Mets and Yankees would be in the same division, like just whoever's closest, basically Angels and Dodgers and Padres, I guess. Anyway, make the case for me for the Travis Sawchuk realignment.
Yeah, I feel this is one of my favorite thought exercises to go through. I try to do it a couple times a year on Twitter and X to get people. I don't know. I just enjoy the topic. And maybe it comes from the fact that I spent some time covering Clemson athletics before I covered Major League Baseball. And I was around not just ACC, but SEC and the rivalries that stem from close geographic proximity and just the fan interest in, you're around your neighbors who follow other teams, and you talk trash to each other, and you get invested in games because of those rivalries. And I think it's hard to substitute that. I think it's largely tied to geography. And there's a University of Arkansas study a few years ago that showed that most rivalries, especially in college, are tied to geography. And I think and there's travel benefits too, if you can reduce this for players and fans traveling. But mostly my motivation was, how can we increase fan interest? And I think great rivalries help that. And could you imagine an AL East where you have the Phillies, Mets, Yankees, Red Sox, Orioles, if Montreal came in with the Blue Jays in that division too, you would have these great rivalries that would be played more often, that wouldn't be tied to only interleague play in some cases that they are today. Or you could have a California-based four-team division or a great West Coast division. You could have Cubs, White Sox, Brewers all playing regularly with the Cardinals in that division. So, yeah, I think it would be fantastic. And interleague play, the feedback is that most people like interleague play, so I might have to rethink that. But I do think baseball's jewel showcase events, like the World Series, like the All-Star Game, benefited from a little mystery in the past. Like, you weren't sure quite which league was better. You never saw these guys play each other. And I think interleague play is, and I know folks will push back on this, but I think it's just less important when every game is televised for the most part, unless you're in a blackout restricted area, which is a topic for another day. But we see these guys more often. And in this age of so many wild cards, I also think there should be just more games against teams competing for these playoff berths, and fewer to zero, play. Do we really need Rockies Royals early in the season? My greater passion though is really in advocating for these geographic alignments. And I think there's all sorts of benefits, from reducing travel, which should help the on-field product, to just creating more geographic-based rivalries, which, I mean, Duke, North Carolina, Alabama, Auburn, Ohio State, most of the great Yankees, Red Sox, most of these great rivalries are tied because you're close to each other. So I think proximity matters.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm for it. Travis Sawchuk, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, and thank you.
That's it for today. Leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to tune in. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.